I'm going to talk now to Professor V. Ramalingaswamy, who is Secretary General of the International Conference on Nutrition, which will be held later this year. In fact, the first week of December, I think it is, in Rome. But he's also some more background, Chairman of the an International Task Force on Health Research for Development. And his life work has been with the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in New Delhi. He's also, at one time, Director General of the Indian Institute of Medical Research, Council of Medical Research, and is now Professor Emeritus of it. So, that said, let me just ask you, if I may, to kick us off, Professor Rama. This conference is a huge undertaking. We have very little time in the program to talk about it. Could you just focus us, help us to focus right down on the priority issue?
The priority issue of this conference is the persistence of hunger and malnutrition on an unacceptable scale in the world today, at a time when the world has the capability to end this state of affairs. This is the dominant theme of this conference. It will also examine the mounting problem of chronic degenerative disease, as we call it, diseases of the heart and blood vessels and some cancers, which have risen considerably in the industrialized world in the past 3 or 4 decades and are now beginning to rear their ugly head or heads in the developing countries, as those countries are beginning to improve their living standards and their economies are growing. So really, to foresee is to govern. Therefore, it is prudent to look at this oncoming problem to the developing countries. And this problem seems to have a link, one of the many links, I must emphasize, but a link with diet and nutrition.
So we have, in fact, an absolute lack of food for many people and the eating of the wrong sort of food for a growing number of people.
Precisely. I think you put it extremely well. Even that lack of food for many people is taking place. It's actually 780 million people in the third world do not get enough food in order to carry out their normal physiological activities. 120 million children under the age of 5 suffer from insufficiency of food. And this is taking place today on a daily basis in a world that, in fact, produces enough food for everybody on this planet to fulfill their physiological needs. That is the problem.
People listening to us would say, though, that this is a long-standing problem and that the United Nations and its various agencies have been trying to draw the world's attention with various conferences over the last 2 or 3 decades to it. What will this conference do and how will it do it that previous conferences on food and health have not achieved?
Well, you're absolutely right. The last conference of this type, but addressed to food, was the World Food Conference in 1974. And you remember the famous dictum that emanated from that conference, "No child shall go to bed hungry."
Henry Kissinger.
And 5 years, I think, was the time that they had set for themselves. I'm not criticizing the setting of goals, but I think the scale of the problem today, I'm not talking of the acute situations, the ones that tear our hearts, like Somalia and the countries of Southern and Central Africa, now facing an unprecedented drought and the destitution and suffering there. I'm not talking, that's an epiphenomenon. That's the one that catches world attention. That is important, that must be addressed on an emergency basis. But there is this silent tragedy chipping away, eroding human life on a vast scale. It's not that progress has not been made. I must say that the UN agencies, as you said, and countries have been doing something. There have been improvements. And in fact, we've been doing fairly well in the 60s and possibly even up to mid-70s, when the economic recession and the debt problem especially became dominant in the 80s, so much so that we talk about the 80s as a lost decade, when many countries, the least developed countries, slipped back very badly, and the gains they made in human development have been lost. So we're now in the 90s, the last decade of this century and this millennium. We are faced with this task of a backlog, a suffering that had taken place in the 80s. So the problem is really vast, of a vast magnitude. But we do have the knowledge, we have the technologies to tackle it in a meaningful way. And essentially, the solutions really lie in being able to tackle the root cause of it, which is poverty.
How, though, will this conference assist with that aim?
Well, the conference is going to put out a declaration and a plan of action. The declaration is, of course, a familiar phenomenon today in most conferences, and some pessimists think that they achieve very little. But a declaration identifies the problems and declares to the world outside the need for urgent action. Coming from the leaders of the world, this would have an impact. But more important than the declaration is the plan of action. The plan of action is set out in a way that will enable each country after the conference to use the guidelines in the plan of action not as prescriptive phenomena, but as guidelines to help them to address their own specific, country-specific situations. One of the most important, one of the themes here is to approach this problem on a three-dimensional scale. One is to ensure household food security throughout the year. The second is to provide health care that will have an impact upon nutrition. And the third, and a rather interesting and daring concept, is to enhance care and caring of the vulnerable groups in this whole action program.
The vulnerable groups being?
The vulnerable groups are those that are poor, that do not have the ability to purchase food. That is the physical and economic vulnerability. There is a social vulnerability in accordance with the social stratification and structure of society. There is a physiological vulnerability. Women in the reproductive age group, young growing children, infants in utero, etc., have special requirements. So a whole stretch of vulnerabilities. And this conference does focus on the issue of vulnerability.
I understand that the countries who will be attending this conference have already, in effect, drawn up an assessment of the situation within their own nations. So this must have focused governments' eyes, really, to the situation as it exists at the moment.
Yes. In fact, this is the most prominent feature of this conference, is it's a process that started in countries. It is entirely focused on the situation in each country. And it is a knowledge-based, action-oriented conference. And each country has provided data, and on the basis of that, an assessment of the global situation with regard to food and nutrition has been prepared, which constitutes the background for this conference.
Bearing in mind the background that the world as a whole faces at the moment, which is financial instability and in many cases financial lack or perceived lack, presumably what comes out of this conference in the way of advice and motivation has got to take into account that there isn't big money available to throw at this problem.
Well, I think that is the reality, and you put your finger on it. We are deeply concerned as to what extent we would be able to mobilize financial resources for a major nutrition initiative. All of us working in the development field, whatever may be our discipline in which we work, have been looking forward to that mirage of a peace dividend. While conditions within the world are perhaps in general improving, although the Secretary General told us yesterday that there are 12 country situations in which the UN is engaged in keeping peace and some 40,000 soldiers are involved. Still, I think the post-Cold War detente scenario is generating hopes in the minds of people that soon we will see a larger flow of resources into human development activities. But to what extent it will materialize is to be seen. But considering that nutrition really is at the heart of human development, that nutrition is both a means as well as an endpoint of development, I am hopeful that considerable resources could be mobilized, especially if we had concrete plans of action which are realistic, which are coherent, and which take place within the countries with the active participation of the people of those countries. I think with that kind of an approach, we are optimistic that we might be able to raise resources. But on the other hand, the emphasis really in this plan of action is on countries themselves doing within their own resources whatever they can possibly do, and perhaps do better than before, with, if needed, some help, catalytic help from outside. And that's the whole purpose of starting it as a country activity 2.5 years ago. I believe that it is possible, even within the existing resources, within the existing structures that are there, to, by better coordination, by better prioritization, by synergism of activities in different sectors, it is possible to get more out of even the current level of investments. This applies both to the countries as well as to the UN agencies. But it's more important than all this is to get the action started on a multi-sectoral basis. The key to nutritional improvement of populations, that nutrition is not a sector, but it depends for its success upon intersectoral cooperation.
Now, you have been working for many, many years with the Indian Institute of Medical Sciences. You were, in fact, Director General of the Indian Council of Medical Research. You have enormous experience of your own country. I hasten to say that I know you don't speak on behalf of the government of India, but let me ask you what a country like India could do, some examples of making the most of what it has in order to achieve these things of better nutrition for its people.
Yes, I think India's example might be relevant to on a somewhat wider scale. For example, the Green Revolution has been a success in India, and it's often quoted, as in many other countries. We would like, for instance, now to see the future of science and technology impinging upon the food production, to focus more and more on legumes and pulses. Not that the focus on cereal grains should be in any way retarded, but there is a need to see that the fruits of biotechnology are generated in areas such as legumes and pulses, which are a source of protein for the poor, for the common people. The whole question of poverty and ability to purchase food is fundamental in India. And I think India is the outstanding example of science and technology being able to produce food and yet millions of people still below the poverty line unable to procure that food. So fundamentally, India's contribution would be, how do you generate income for the poor families? What strategies do you use to enable them to purchase the food? The tragedy of 25 or 30 million tons of food grains not being able to be stored properly, not enough space, and people by millions not having enough food to eat. We simply have to resolve this. How do you do it? How do you generate employment? Even when you give food aid or subsidies, how do you do it in such a way that it is a part of a developmental activity, food for work, for example, small credits for these families, the status of women in society. When you go deeply into how you do it, you're really striking at the grassroots of development. This is overall development. And I think this is what we need to address, whether we are talking about nutrition or talking about environment or talking about population. I think there is now a commonality of issues that need to be resolved. I would say that India's contribution or relevance to this whole debate would be, how do you use science and technology to overcome the shackles of poverty?
While governments are pondering and attempting certain things, can the poor people do anything at all, or are they in absolute lack? Is there any action that they can take in this sector to improve their own, you know, their own situation?
I think we are already seeing manifestations of a stirring on the part of the people themselves, but perhaps not on a scale large enough to produce a major impact. But one should exploit the participation of people in the development process which is beginning. And I think the overall climate in general, the post-Cold War climate, is conducive to action at the periphery local action, local government involving the people. And this kind of a movement that is already in evidence in many parts of the developing world, and certainly in India, you know about the environment movement, which is people-based, who resist cutting of the trees, for example, by the timber merchants. These have grown people's movements that are agitating against large dams, for example, for hydroelectric power generation, as well as for irrigation. People are participating in a discussion on the short-term and the long-term benefits, as well as risks that accompany these activities. An intelligent dialogue, of course, often tinged with emotionalism, is going on. I think on the whole, the involvement of people in the development process is the crux of the whole problem. And I believe that the currents have already begun to take place.
But are there examples in India or elsewhere of the poorest people actually, you feel, achieving progress in this in the self-help, if you like, of improving their nutrition?
Yes. Well, there is, for example, let's take Bangladesh. And the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh is a well-known example. And here you have small groups of women from the poor families asking for credit, and they are then organized, and this has produced a very significant impact on their ability to produce and on their ability to earn more. And when income generation occurs, and when women have a greater control over that generated income, we know that development follows. Children especially are a special focus of attention. I've mentioned about the environment movement, of course, and the cutting of the trees. There have been small-scale studies which have taken place on a micro level in different parts of India, where people have become the main movers of an activity and have improved their own health.
Is this through things like home gardens or something else?
Yes, well, home gardens, kitchen gardens, and using wastewater, community gardens, community production in villages, etc. These have all been taking place. There was some 15, 20 years ago, the community development movement in India. There was also the applied nutrition program where these activities have started. I think the climate exists, but one needs to capitalize on this evident enlightenment or knowledge in the part of the people, and then enable them to do more.
Finally, there's the question of eating the wrong things. And in India, in Sri Lanka, in a number of other countries in Southeast Asia, certainly in the Caribbean and parts of Africa, we see where people have the ability to buy food, but they buy the wrong food for their own good.
Yes. Well, this is the... there are two facets to this problem. One is that people have the ability to buy food or to grow food within their own land holdings of the right type and consume it. They don't. Many of them don't do it, and a good slice of malnutrition problem is due to this. The other side to it is with rising incomes and with urbanization, there is this well-established tendency to consume foods that are more refined, foods that have less fiber, foods that have less complex carbohydrate, to consume foods that are higher in fat, especially in saturated fat, along with very often a reduced physical activity and possibly abuse, smoking and alcohol abuse. Not that it takes place in every instance, but as a mass phenomenon one sees with development and with urbanization, with the breakup of the traditional joint family system, loosening of the moors of a joint family, one sees this happening. And I think one should also at the same time look at this and try to do something before it becomes too late.
So in effect, looking at these two areas of concern, not enough food and where you have enough money for food, the wrong food, you feel that the outcome of the nutritional conference will show the way to helping us right these two wrongs in the foreseeable future.
That is our hope. And we place our maximum possible emphasis on people and on countries.
Professor Ramalinga Swamy, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And we wish you well for the conference, not only for yourselves, of course, but for ourselves, because we will, of course, be the beneficiaries in the long term.
Thank you.